studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Well, last week, NOAA reported that the average U.S. temperature for this past winter, December through February, was 35.9 degrees Fahrenheit. This tied with the 1997-98 year for sixth place among the 122 years of record-keeping.
More interesting, all but one of the seven warmest U.S. winters on record have occurred since 1997, with three of those recorded in the 2010s. Joining us in the first part of the show to discuss what our winter was like here in Utah will be Brian McInerney, senior hydrologist with the National Weather Service out of Salt Lake City.
By most accounts, it looks like we had an above-average snowfall this winter, which is good for our watershed, but what impact will the extra warm temperatures predicted for this week have on our snowpack and runoff? Brian has some thoughts.
Of course he does. By most accounts, So then in the second part of the show, author Dan Egan joins us to discuss his book, The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. Dan is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and has been covering the Great Lakes for years, having been a finalist twice for the Pulitzer Prize. Lakes Erie, Huron, Michigan, Ontario, and Superior hold 21% of the world's supply of fresh water and provide sustenance work and recreation for tens of millions of Americans.
But they are under threat as never before, from industrial and domestic wastewater outfalls to non-point sources of pollution from farming to invasive species such as zebra mussels and Asian carp, and of course, warming waters associated with climate change.
The Death and Life of the Great Lakes is Dan Egan's portrait of both the ecological challenges the lakes face while examining the actions we must pursue to restore and preserve them for future generations.
Now, we don't take phone calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth. Our connections with and impacts upon the environment, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
This is Allison Kulo with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Joining the Chamber Bureau provides your business with benefits, from lodging projections, educational videos, group sales leads, and a listing on the top travel site for Park City, and much more. Becoming a member of the Park City Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business. Information on joining can be found at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization and KPCW supporter.
This is Deacon Haymond, head honcho at Haymond Law. In life and in death, we support KPCW. We prepare wills and trusts and provide guidance on income and estate taxes. We can also answer questions about the loss of a loved one or the loss of someone who isn't loved but must be dealt with anyway. Our office is at Kimball Junction, and more information is at deaconhaymond.com.
Hi, this is Brenda with Republic Services, your local source for recycling and garbage collection and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. As you recycle, please remember, glass cannot go in your residential curbside recycling bin. Thank you for helping to keep Summit County clean and green. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability and just what in the world is going on in Washington, D.C.?
Is that the new name of our show?
Yeah,
what in the world?
What in the world is going on in Washington, D.C. with respect to our environment? We'll get to that later, perhaps. But Brian McInerney, senior hydrologist with the National Weather Service out of Salt Lake City, joins us every 3 months or so. And he's here to talk about, among other things, how this past winter unfolded. Because, Brian, I remember when you were here, December 20th or 21st, you did something very unusual, if you recall. You actually made a prediction, a bit of a prediction, that was...
Brian is looking skeptical right now, for the record.
I could bring the tape up if you want. But basically, you said that you thought that looking somewhat weeks ahead, you felt like that we were going to have a pretty decent start to the winter because of certain conditions that were unfolding on a large mesoscale or so.
Yeah.
And how did that work out? Did it work out really well, actually? What happened?
So what the meteorologists at the National Weather Service, they look at the global pattern. If you look down on the North Pole, like from the Earth from above, and see what the wave pattern looks like, They noticed that the cold pool that and the low pressure that's over the Hudson Bay had shifted, and it wasn't there, and it was over Siberia and parts of Alaska. And what that indicated, it's like we're taking rocks out of a river and moving them around. So the flow or the jet stream was going to go farther south. And they saw that in that cold pool and that anomalous cold water in the North Pacific and thought, with that, the jet stream is going to go farther south. And it won't have a big high pressure like we've had the last 5 years. And that was encouraging. Hmm. And it worked out just as they suggested. We had numerous storms December, January, and then through February, and it worked out really well to the tune of snowpacks at the beginning of February, about 175 to 200% of median. And that's a great start to the winter. When you look at the temperatures we had in December and January, it was colder than normal, and it was definitely above normal precipitation. We had 2 to 3, some places 4 times the normal precip through December, January, and February. And as a result, we have snowpacks right now that are 150 to 175% of median. And that's fabulous right now. The catch to this is that when we moved into February, there was a little voice that we were kind of worried about, because last year we had similar snowpack in December and January. And then February hit and the high pressure hit us. And we turned off the storms and we went below again. But what happened was the storms were actually coming in February, but they were anomalously warm to mm-hmm. the tune of 15 degrees above wow. average. If you look mm-hmm. at the first part of February, we were 15 degrees above average, and we had storms moving in, atmospheric river storms, which are copiously wet and, you know, really violent storms, but they were rained up to 9,000 feet. So we had snow above that, very dense snow. We had a lot of wind, and we had rain all throughout the areas up to 9,000 feet. And then we had a couple of really good winter storms coming out of the northwest. They kind of saved us just from a February that was a lack of any storms. And it was really a violent storm. And if you remember, it was about a week to 10 days ago
right.
that we had winds at 117 miles an hour at the top of Snowbird.
Right. Wow.
So that kind of kept the snowpack going, that really cold spell, but we're back to high pressure and very warm conditions, and this is melting the snow at the lower elevations at a very good clip.
I was just going to ask about that. So it seems like at the lower elevations, most of our snow has melted. I look at the mountains and there's still snow covered. How's the snowpack up there doing?
It's actually quite good. It's 150% of median right now.
So it's still really high.
It's still doing well. The difference is when you have a very large snowpack like we have right now, it takes a long time to get it ripe, to get it 32 degrees from top to bottom. If you notice the snow at the lower elevation, 6,500, that's melting off really fast. And that's because it's a much smaller snowpack. It gets isothermal much quicker, and then it yields meltwater off. Plus, we've had wind, and we've had a lot of solar radiation, more so than you would get in a very stormy month. That also contributes energy to the snowpack and melts it off really quick. And that's what we're seeing right now. About a week ago, Park City looked pretty white. Now it's looking pretty brown. But if you look up on the mountain and where we measure snow and the north-facing aspects, it's really about the same. It's just changing. The physics of the snowpack is evolving. And hopefully we can add a few more storms before that starts getting isothermal top to bottom and we start melting that off. But it's anytime you melt early, you can lose up to 50% of your snowpack to the atmosphere, to evaporation, to transpiration. Plants come back early. And we've seen that roughly from 2000 to 2004, the Weber Basin, we did a quick study on it, and it showed that over 50% of the snow, the water in the snowpack evaporated, transpired, and it went away. And then you look at 2005, which is a very stormy end of the winter and a very stormy spring, and we went almost 1-to-1, where we had 100% snowpack and 100% into the reservoirs, what you'd expect. We still mm-hmm. have losses, but we don't want to melt early. Anytime you melt early, even though we have a really, really big snowpack, you have great losses with that early melting, and we're doing that right now.
Okay, Brian, as usual, we've asked two questions, and you've answered all 7 of mine. Okay, sorry. And we have
He's
another.
I know you have that
He's
look on your face.
Inside our
we have another 12 minutes.
Well,
to
I've
go.
Got another question.
Okay,
lucky
thank
for you,
you
both.
That's why we're a team.
So Brian, just looking at the melt, there's already been some concern this year about flooding because we have had such high snowpack.
Yeah.
With that February thaw, some of this lower elevation snow melt, what do you anticipate the runoff looking like this spring?
I think we just need to look back what happened at the beginning of this winter in December. When you look, what were your precipitation levels? Were they close to average? They were 2 to 3, up to 4 times the average of what you typically get. And mm-hmm. we move into January, 3 to 4 times what you typically get. Then we look at the temperatures in February, 15 degrees above average. So then you're going to say, well, what's going to happen for the remainder of March and into April? Are we going to be average? And we're going to be anything but average, most likely. Hopefully this warm trend won't continue. Hopefully we'll go into a more progressive weather pattern that we saw before. And if you look at the last 2 years, May had 400% precipitation. It came in the form of rain and a great part of this, mm-hmm. but we still got 400% precipitation in May. Now, when you look at the hydrologists that are at the River Forecast Center, the Colorado Basin River Forecast Center, they're trying to forecast water supply from April 1st through the end of July. And anytime you're having these wild swings, it's very difficult to forecast beyond 7 days what's going to happen. So hopefully we'll see this pattern progress. We could have additional storminess really all the way through the rest of the winter and into the spring, because roughly April, the first week of April, is when the snowpacks reach their largest volume, and then they start to melt on average. But when you look at what happened this year and really last year, this is something we're going to see a lot of on a regular basis. Mm. This is climate change and hitting home, because when you look at the range of temperatures that you typically get, 15 degrees above average, and we even went up to 23 degrees above average on one day down in Salt Lake City. That's so far out of the range.
That's,
but when you look at the
multiple
science,
deviations beyond
right. yeah.
2-3 deviations. But so if the average was 38, it was low 60s or something.
Right. And really, when you look at February, we started warming the second day, and we went for about the next 10, 11, 12 days.
And it
days.
Rained. I know we talked one of our shows, it was raining. And one of the consequences we're seeing, that snow rain line going up.
Yeah, we're going to see more of that as we continue. Like we talked about before, right around 2035 to 2065, areas that are 100% snow covered in the Wasatch are only going to be 50% snow covered. We're going to have less snow and more rain, and we're seeing that right now. This progression of increased rainfall during the meteorological winter is occurring. So it shouldn't be any surprise that we're warming prematurely. The problem with that is you lose a lot of the water to premature melt. It's very inefficient. You don't want to see it. You want to have cold weather all the way through the winter and then mm-hmm. a cold, wet spring. But we're warming our climate, and that's going to bring on premature melt on a regular basis.
So how are our reservoirs looking at this point as far mm-hmm. as how full they are? Over the past few years, we've been talking about them getting lower. Mm-hmm. We were a little worried.
Yeah.
Has this recharged them?
Yeah, it mm-hmm. really has. And the forecast calls for we're going to fill just about all the reservoirs except for the really large one, Bear Lake, Lake Powell. Lake Powell is forecast as of a week ago to rise 50 feet.
Wow.
50 feet. A 5-story building increase from April 1st through the end of July. When you look at that inflow from Colorado and Utah. Now, granted, that's the forecast that was made a week ago. Yeah. If we continue to melt at the rate we're going with the higher temperatures, that forecast is going to decline because, we're just not going to put that much water. We're going to lose it to the atmosphere. But if you then think, okay, we've been one of extremes, hopefully we'll just go into a wet extreme, a very stormy extreme, very progressive weather pattern, and we can maintain this forecast. The forecast for really all of our river points and inflow into the reservoirs has been steadily increasing since December due to this incredible weather pattern we've been in. Mm-hmm. Now we're going to see what's going to happen for the next 2 weeks and then into the spring months, and that'll shape this forecast. But it's very encouraging that we could fill the majority of the reservoirs and maybe put a big dent in Bear Lake and a big dent in Lake Powell.
Well, a 50-foot rise, would that bring it? Where would that bring it to? I mean, above average, or that's how much?
That's how low it is,
in a sense. Yeah. So, five stories of water, effectively coming into the lake over the next 5 months or so.
Yeah.
What's the green in Colorado going to look like? Bringing all this water down there.
When you look at the forecast for the green, it's up to 200 inflow into Flaming Gorge Reservoir.
Yeah.
The forecast calls for about 240% of average, 2.5 times what they typically get.
Right.
Colorado is not as big as Utah, but it's still above average flows forecasted throughout the spring. So when you combine the green, the Colorado, parts of the Duchesne at one point had 200% snowpack, all of these all come down and go into Lake Powell. Then you see how it's managed. It's going to be sent down to Lake Mead, and then it's going to be doled out. And really, Lake Powell may never fill again when you look at the management of it and how much water we're anticipated in over time. But when you look at the science of climate change, temperature is a given. We're rising. We're going to warm 12 degrees above where we are by 2100. If we do business as usual, most likely that's going to increase from where we anticipate, because we're changing really the idea of clean energy back to coal and natural gas and those things. But it's just going to get warmer. They anticipated it was going to get drier. Now there's some new science saying maybe it'll be wetter overall, but we're going to have losses. That's where the climate scientists are really wrestling with, what the precipitation regime is going to be with a warmer climate.
One given that we know at this point, right, is that it's just going to be essentially more unpredictable, more extreme.
Right. Yeah. And we see that with the jet stream. If you look at the jet stream back like at 1950s, 1960s, it was a little wiggles that go around the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere. Now the jet stream has these long, elongated sine waves because the poles are warming at a much faster rate than the equator. And as a result, the atmosphere is trying to equate itself by having the jet stream go from near, you know, farther south and go farther north. And at once this year, it even crossed the equator. That's how elongated the jet stream is going. Whereas before, it would be little wiggles. So when you think each little wiggle is a storm.
It's almost physically impossible. Because the Coriolis effect, you know. Okay.
But it did. And that
highly
was kind
unusual.
Of freaked everybody out.
Yes.
Like, holy cow, look how far down it's gone. It went to the equator, past the equator. And when you think historically, it was little wiggles. Each little wiggle was a storm. And we used to get storms on a regular basis here. And it was the variability of our storms was very low. Now they're getting more irregular because the jet stream is more elongated. We're getting more extreme weather. And it was evidenced in December, January, and February in both temperature and precip.
I was just visited the National Snow and Ice Data Center yesterday to get the latest on sea ice coverage in the Arctic. And right now, they're at record levels. They've been at record low levels for the entire year. Again, 2 to 3 deviations below average. In fact, where they are today is where they typically would be, where the Arctic would be in the end of April. So the sea ice loss is running 6 weeks ahead. But it's been low all year.
Yeah.
So because they've had record temperatures up in some areas of the Arctic and Greenland, et cetera.
Yeah.
And that's all. But that's all part of the, I guess, again, the new normals and the reset that's going on with our climate at large.
And
that has a big influence on the jet stream, too.
Yeah.
Right?
That's a bigger one. And when you look at normal, people say, well, what's normal? Normal is the average. When you look at data, we average it from 81 to 2010, a 30-year average.
Right.
But if you take 1971 to 2000, excuse me, and look at where we are now, you'll say, holy cow, we're much warmer and much drier than where we were. But it's just the new norm. And if you go back to the 60s, you'll find it was cooler and a little wetter. We're slowly getting warmer and drier as we continue. And that's if we eventually go to 91 to, you know, 2020, then we'll see it even more. It would be much warmer and probably much drier, depending on where
but
we
that,
are.
But that 30-year average will be warmer, too.
Yeah.
So we're going to be comparing annual warmth against a warmer 30-year average.
A moving target.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it doesn't, it kind of tamps down that differences or so.
So you can say, well, but we're close to normal, but really, if you look at what is normal,
the normal has been increasing every 30-year period.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's what, again, that's what you said, like way back in the beginning, you said, today we're at 175 to 200% our snowpack of median, and median being a long-term period of an average calculated over a 30-year period.
Yeah.
200%. Wow. And, we have a couple minutes. According to NOAA, this was the fourth wettest winter that Utah experienced.
Yeah.
Of 122 or 123 years of data keeping. So makes sense, right?
So I think the last thing we need to address is what kind of flood threat do we have?
Yeah.
And if it keeps going the way it's going with this warmer, drier weather for the next week, the flood threat gets knocked off every day that we have this weather. If you look at 1983, people were asking, is it similar to 83? 83 was somewhat of an average year all the way until the late winter into the spring, and then it just kept going. It kept snowing through May and about June, and then we flipped the switch, brought the sun on, turned the heat on, and it all came off at once. But we didn't have this monstrous snowpack that we do now. It's just that the late winter and the spring were very wet and very wild weather. And we're not seeing that now. So every day we melt more snow and evolve the snowpack up on the hill, our flood threat starts going away. But again, we had 400% precip last May. It's going to be tough to forecast that overall.
Yeah, because it's still winter.
Yeah.
We haven't even started spring, effectively.
Yeah.
So there's still a lot of snow that could fall over these next 6 weeks or so. And so now, what would you say was the wettest year you've experienced at Swanner as far as flood conditions?
Oh, that's a tough question.
Because you've had floods there, effect high water enough to get into residential areas and New Park area, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that used to happen before they installed the new system on an annual basis.
Right.
But, I'm looking back, I want to say it was 2010.
Yeah, I think you're right.
One of the wettest that I remember, in addition to some of the earlier years back in the 2006.
2011, we had record volume runoff.
Right.
We didn't have high peak flows, but we had record volumes during that year. That was our benchmark for some of the biggest flows we've ever had.
And that's often when we tend to see the most water, when there's that flashier or more of a spike in the runoff, there's a little bit less water in the wetlands versus running through the stream. So it's interesting for us to watch. Yeah.
Well, it's all in play as usual. But it's good news. I guess the takeaway here, it's good news in terms watershed recharge. Like you're saying, reservoirs are recharging. And that's something we haven't seen in a number of years.
And the skiing was fantastic this year. We should talk about the powder days we've had this year.
You can go on another show
and
discuss
that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Brian, as usual, plug your website for those who want to learn more about
weather.gov,
what you study.
Or do a search on all the stuff we talked about, CBRFC for Colorado Basin River Forecast Center. You can get all sorts of good information on river forecasts, snowpack, water supply, all those good things. Colorado Basin River Forecast Center. Or weather.gov if you want to know the weather at your house.
Colorado Basin River Forecast Center. Nice.
Yeah.
All right, Brian.
Thanks again.
As always, it's great to have you on, and we'll see you in 3 months.
Okay. See you in 3 months.
Thanks, Brian.
All right. Let's take a break for some underwriters, sponsors. And when we come back, we're speaking with Dan Egan, the author of his book, The Death and Life of the Great Lakes, It's This Green Earth.
Groundbreaking Innovations in Clay is the Kimball Art Center's first exhibition dedicated entirely to ceramics, featuring 12 world-renowned artists who are pushing the boundaries of clay. Some of those artists are teaching classes at the Kimball Clay Studio. Class prices and times are online at kimballartcenter.org. Groundbreaking is free and open to the public through April 16th. The Kimball Art Center is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter. Art starts here.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. KPCW is one of the many nonprofits our agents and company support. They are the backbone of Summit and Wasatch Counties in our incredible community. More info at bhhsutah.com.
Miller Orthodontics supports KPCW and their involvement with area youth and teens. Speaking of youth, did you know Invisalign has a specific type of aligner just for teens? Over 3/4 of our Invisalign patients are 19 or younger. More information about Invisalign Teen is available at m2ortho.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us for the second part of the show today is author Dan Egan, who will be discussing his new book, The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. Dan is a reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's twice been a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and he has won the Alfred I. DuPont Columbia University Award, John B. Oakes Award, AAAS Kavli Science Journalism Award, and many others. He's a graduate of the Columbia Journalism School and the University of Michigan. He now lives in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, with his wife and children, and again recently released his book, The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. Dan, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with this. How did you come to focus on the Great Lakes so specifically in your journalism career?
Well, it's interesting. I grew up in Wisconsin. I went to college in Michigan, and then I moved out to Idaho after college. And my first job was at the Idaho Mountain Express up in Sun Valley. Huh. And one of my first assignments was, this was 1992, I believe. One of my first assignments was to go up into the Sawtooth Mountains and cover a vigil for the sockeye salmon that were supposed to be returning that late summer. The problem was they weren't. By the end of the summer, only one sockeye salmon had made the trip. Hmm. And they called him Lonesome Larry, and he was stripped of his milt or sperm, and that was used as a captive breeding program. And it was just something that really impressed me to see, you know, a species that close to the brink of extinction. And as I understand it, those redfish sockeye are they're still hanging on, but they're only hanging on largely due to a captive breeding program. So anyway, after I worked in Sun Valley, I worked in Idaho Falls, and then I worked at the Salt Lake Tribune, actually, from 97 to 2002.
Oh, wow.
And then I moved back to Wisconsin, and I remember right when I returned going down to the lakefront with my daughter and seeing all the fishermen going after Lake Michigan salmon, and it just kind of thrilled me, the idea that my daughter was going to grow up in a place where salmon aren't in existence only because of captive breeding program. I soon learned I was really wrong. I had a vague notion that salmon had been planted in the Great Lakes a while back, but I had figured that they had established themselves and didn't need to be supported with hatchery plantings. That was not the case. The only reason those salmon were swimming in Lake Michigan that day is because of a massive annual stocking program. I mean, it's basically a big put and take fishery. It's kind of a fish farm. And I decided to write a story about the history of the salmon stocking, and that just led to more stories about the ecological state of the Great Lakes. And that was back in 2003, and I'm still writing about it. So I guess I'm just fascinated by the lakes and what's happened to them and what is happening to them.
Well, five different lakes, obviously, of different sizes and settings. What is there? Do the lakes have different threats, or they all face sort of common threats? Do they have unique threats to them?
Yeah. Well, I'm hearing a little bit of an echo. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It's rattling me a little bit with my thought. But yeah, you know, they're all different bodies of water, and they have some common problems, and they have some distinct problems. I focus a lot on Lake Michigan. That's not surprising because I live three blocks from Lake Michigan. And what's going on right now here is kind of an ecological shakedown like nothing anybody has ever seen in the history of the Great Lakes. And it's driven largely by quagga mussels, which I'm guessing you guys are a little bit familiar with.
Yes.
And are probably, unfortunately, going to become more familiar with as years progress. But yeah, we're in danger of losing our salmon fishery on Lake Michigan because the quagga mussels have so stripped the plankton from the base of the food chain that everything above is starting to get wobbly, salmon included. And this is a fairly recent phenomenon, even though the quagga mussels have been in the Great Lakes since the early 1990s. They didn't really take off until 2003 or so, and they've played a big role in destroying the salmon fishery on Lake Huron and appear to be doing the same thing now on Lake Michigan.
Go ahead.
Well, I traveled out to Utah, I believe it was 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It might have been 3 years ago, back when, just after Lake Powell had, I guess I'll use the word, fallen to the quagga invasion.
Sure.
And I was talking with Park Service biologists at the time, and they were talking about the lengths that they had gone to keep that from happening, all the boat inspection stations and the power washing and
right.
the fines. And it just kind of blew me away, the ethic that you guys have out there to prevent the spread of these things. We don't really share that. We are, to me, it seems like Wisconsin and the rest of the Midwest, the Great Lakes states, has been a little more fatalistic. Like once they got into the Great Lakes, oh, well, what are we going to do about it? And that's unfortunate.
You know, that's such an interesting comment. I'm originally from upstate New York, and you know, an area where there are hundreds of lakes. And I noticed the same thing that here in Utah, the program for education and prevention of these aquatic invasives is way more stringent. And maybe that's because there are fewer water bodies to regulate and there's just more bandwidth.
Mm.
But it's certainly something I notice. But backing up a little bit to the quagga mussel getting into the Great Lakes and the zebra mussel and some of these other invasives, walk us through how that started to happen historically.
Well, it started with the opening of the St. Lawrence Seaway back in 1959. Now, if you look at a map, it looks like the Great Lakes are connected to the ocean. And they are in a way. I mean, they're not static water bodies. They're constantly flowing west to east out toward the Atlantic Ocean and being refilled with precipitation and water coming in from their tributaries. But it's not a smooth sail, naturally. You've got Niagara Falls between the Upper Great Lakes, which would be Michigan, Huron, Erie, and Superior. And so you have Niagara Falls blocking any kind of upward migration from the East Coast for those lakes. And then Lake Ontario, which is below Niagara Falls, also sits above at the headwaters of the St. Lawrence River, which is a big, wild, tumbling river, which was also very difficult for things to migrate up. The St. Lawrence Seaway changed that. It basically tamed the river with a series of locks and channels, and then the construction of the Welland Canal around Niagara Falls gave ships access from all over the world into the Great Lakes. And the problem is they didn't bring just the cargoes that were listed on their manifest, but they brought contaminated ballast water, and that's how we have since been invaded by dozens of non-native species, including the quagga and zebra mussels. And what's interesting, I think, for Utah listeners is the idea that you know, if you've been at one of these boat checkpoints or roadside checkpoints, you know the, you know, how difficult it is. There's lots of boats, lots of roads, a lot of reservoirs and irrigation waterways. It's almost a noble effort, but in some ways it seems like, you know, ultimately it's kind of futile in that, you know, they're gonna get where they're gonna go eventually. But there is one choke point where something like this could be stopped, and that's at the front gate of the seaway. It's 80 feet wide, this choke point. It's the first lock on the seaway called the St. Lambert Lock. And when those gates open to allow a boat in from overseas, they're opening to the whole continent. I mean, if all Utah had to do was control one boat ramp, I think they could get a handle on this problem.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But it's bigger than that. Strangely enough, you know, here in the Great Lakes, it isn't that big. It's an 80-foot door, and every time we open it, we're risking another invasion of the continent of something that, you know, can be both ecologically and economically big trouble.
We're speaking with Dan Egan. He's the author of The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. And while we're on invasive species, what's the situation with Asian carp?
Yeah, they've been migrating up the Mississippi River Basin for a long time. They were first imported. So these Asian carp are like supersized common carp.
Right.
But unlike common carp, they don't root around in a lake bottom or a river bottom. They're filter feeders. Kind of like mini baleen whales, only they're not that mini either. They can get to be more than 100 pounds. And they were imported back in the early 1970s by one particular fish farmer who was interested in using them to control weed growth and algae in his fish farm ponds. He turned them over to the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission, and they ended up breeding these things and using them in sewage treatment experiments.
Right.
And the idea was they would eat everything in a sewage lagoon.
Right,
and
kind then, of a polishing.
Yeah, effect. Yeah, kind of an elegant idea.
Yeah.
But when funding evaporated for that in 1980 or so, after the Carter administration left, these fish were set free, and they had such a heck of a time getting them to breed that they didn't think that they in laboratories that they didn't think that they'd possibly breed in the wild, and they were, of course, very wrong. And these fish, and what makes them such a menace is a couple of things. They can eat up to 20% of their weight in plankton a day, and they can grow to over 100 pounds, as I said. But they also jump out of the water.
Yes.
When agitated by the whir of a boat motor. Anyway, they've been migrating steadily north, and they're now pretty much at the gates, or actually literally at the gates of the Great Lakes, just to the southwest of downtown Chicago. They're in the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal, which is kind of, I like to think of the St. Lawrence Seaway as the front door to the Great Lakes, and the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal is the back door. Both provide connections to the outside aquatic world that weren't naturally there. So they're being held back by an electric fence at the moment, or an electric barrier, a system of electric barriers. But there's been evidence that that barrier isn't operating at a strong enough voltage to repel juvenile fish. Mm-hmm. And they have found Asian carp DNA in Lake Michigan. It doesn't mean that the fish are in there and breeding, but not a good sign.
Right.
Well, Dan, I want to talk about the title of the book a little bit, The Death and Life of the Great Lakes, and what that refers to. You know, in the book, you talk about how the Great Lakes were sort of withstood this industrial abuse for many years, and then maybe saw a little bit of a renaissance, and now are facing a new set of challenges. Is that right?
Yeah, and you know, that title is kind of a riff on The Death and Life of the Great American Cities by Jane Jacobs years ago, and it actually wasn't my idea. It was I think it was conceived of by the editor. I had originally thought of calling it Liquid Desert, because that's exactly how it was described to me by the last commercial fisherman to pull out of Milwaukee back in 2011. The fishery had so collapsed, largely because of this mussel invasion, that he moved to Alaska, where he's catching more pounds of fish in a day than he was catching all year long here in Milwaukee. But the Death in Life, the idea is, you know, it has it being the Great Lakes. They have gone under such a huge, undergone such a huge transformation since, pick a year, I guess I'll say 1940, when the first wave of invaders arrived prior to the opening of the Seaway. There was a smaller shipping system that allowed things to swim up into the lakes on their own. And the first wave was sea lampreys and alewives. And they basically, the lampreys took out the lake trout, which were basically the wolves in the system, the king of the food chain. And with those big fish gone, a little invasive fish, the alewife, just exploded to the point where 9 out of every 10 pounds of fish swimming in the lake was in Lake Michigan, I'm talking of specifically, was alewife. And so that's why we brought in these salmon. The old lady who saw the fly. We bring in Pacific salmon to eat an Atlantic invader, and now that system is in danger of crashing again because of the surge in quagga mussels. They're just taking so much of the food, the energy out of the system that it's hard for anything to make a go of it.
Is there...
Although it's not all gloom and doom, because there is yet another invader, the round goby, which feasts on quagga mussels, and some native fish species are starting to eat gobies. And so lake trout are doing remarkably well in some areas, as are whitefish and walleye. So it's kind of like the food chain is stitching itself, the food web
right.
is stitching itself back together a bit.
And that's interesting how, yeah, the food chain resets. We always talk about how on the show, I think, you know, ecosystems reset and shift. Can the zebra and quagga mussels be harvested? Is there any economical value to these?
No.
No?
No, unfortunately not. I mean, they're too small to eat, and, you know, they probably are concentrating some bad stuff anyway. But no, there's no like, nutritional market for
right.
them. There's really not much you can do about them. I mean, at least the gobies are here to eat them, and the gobies are becoming food for fish that people want to fish for.
Good.
So,
now, these mussels can cause, like, billions of dollars of damage, right?
Right.
Yeah. You know, they don't just rewire the way energy flows or doesn't flow through an ecosystem, but they also clog pipes. And that's what's so troublesome, you know, from a financial standpoint. These power companies, city water drinking systems, anything that has a pipe going into the lake, and there's a lot of these things, is in a nonstop battle to keep those pipes open and flowing. And I can only imagine what will happen if they get into the Pacific Northwest and the Columbia River Basin with all the hydro plants on the Columbia and Snake Rivers, they say, yeah, this is a multi-billion-dollar threat up there as well. So,
well, we don't want to over-focus on just the mussel issues that Great Lakes faces.
Yeah.
There's point sources from in industry discharges, municipal treatment plants discharge treated wastewater into the lake. There's non-point sources from farming operations. Lake is, you know, the lakes are constantly, daily under challenge with respect to different sources of pollutants. There's plastics that we've talked about on our show in the past that are, you know, being discharged in the lake and showing up in the lake,
yeah.
et cetera. So there's a host of challenges that these lakes face now and in the future.
There are, but, you know. Am I interrupting? I don't know.
No, go ahead.
Okay. But the thing is like, even non-point source pollution, a big problem facing the lakes right now is just phosphorus overload, and it's fueling algae blooms.
Right.
We know how to fix that, and we could fix it if, you know, we get tough with regulations. And there's some movement toward it, but it hasn't happened yet. Much like, you know, the Clean Water Act in 1972, after the Cuyahoga River caught fire for the last time. I mean, mm-hmm. that's notable. That river was burning for most of the 20th century.
Right.
It was just for some reason in 1969 when it burst into flames, the public had enough and said, we got to stop letting industry do what it wants to the lakes. And we got the Clean Water Act out of that. And the recovery was fast and remarkable. And the lakes, you know, as much abuse as they've taken, they're still big, beautiful lakes that supply drinking water to tens of millions of people and fishing as well. The problem with the Clean Water Act is that it didn't address contaminated ballast water, which is the source for all these invasive species. And that changed recently with a lawsuit, and now the Environmental Protection Agency is supposed to start cracking down on the shipping industry and requiring water treatment systems to stop the next invasion. But this is a vexing problem because you can cap a smokestack and plug a pipe, but with invasive species, it's not something that'll decay or disperse over time. It breeds. So that's, you know, there are other issues. There are sewage discharges, microplastics, phosphorus.
Right.
But a big core issue is this biological pollution that it has not yet been adequately addressed.
It's so interesting because all of those issues you mentioned, you know, are things obviously that are relevant here locally and Park City and Summit County and Utah as a whole that we talk about. And it seems like the Great Lakes are sort of this like canary in the coal mine, you know, like these problems are coming to that area first because of the intensity of use.
Yeah. And yeah, they're a beachhead for invasions that, you know, I don't know if inevitably, but are likely to go national. And yeah, it is where a lot of problems start. So
what is next? Go ahead.
Excuse me. Well, I'm just saying, you know, if we can shut this door, you know, this relatively narrow door, this 80-foot wide opening to the seaway, and I'm not saying we should close the seaway. I'm just saying that boats need to be, you know, mandated to install adequate ballast treatment systems so we don't get more invasions. And if they can't, if it's too expensive or too technologically challenging, then maybe, yeah, don't let the overseas component of the seaway traffic into the lake.
Right.
And it really isn't that big of an industry. It's an average of 2 ships a day coming in.
Wow.
And that, yeah, and it's a 9-month shipping season because of ice. And so the volume of cargo that they're bringing in, and it isn't like Nikes and Sonys and Toyotas. It's low-value bulk goods,
right.
Steel primarily coming in and grain going out. And some logistics experts have looked at, you know, what would it cost if we brought that stuff in on trains instead of these boats? And they estimated it would be an additional $50 million a year, which is a pretty small number compared to the economic and ecological impact things have had on the
lakes. I was shocked to read that there are 186 invasives in the Great Lakes.
Non-native.
Okay, non-native.
Because some of them, you know, that number includes the Pacific salmon. But yeah,
sure.
There's a lot, and you know, that number really took off after the seaway opened. As far as you know, the rate of invasions we were getting, finding a new organism in the lakes every 6 months for a while. So, and I have to say, the shipping industry has taken some pretty strong steps as far as managing their ballast water. They flushed those ballast tanks mid-ocean with salt water, and that the idea being they'll kill or expel any unwanted freshwater hitchhikers. And it's done a lot. I mean, they've only found one new invader in the lake since they started doing this in 2006, but a lot of biologists say the door might have been largely closed, but it's still open enough for something to come through, and it needs to be shut.
Hmm. Well, looking forward, you know, we've got a few minutes left. What is next for this system?
You know, I hope it's stability. And as I mentioned, you know, there are signs of this happening, particularly on Lake Huron. The salmon and the alewives are pretty much gone, and all these native species that will go after. The problem is salmon won't deign to go down to the bottom of the lakes and bang their noses around the rocks to get the gobies and the mussels can cut their faces up.
Mm-hmm.
But lake trout do. I mean, and so do walleye and so do whitefish, which aren't even a fish-eating fish. They're eating gobies because it's bat or die.
Wow.
And so, commercial fishermen are saying they see these whitefish come in with, like, their cheeks ripped because they're having to get their mouths around a fish that they were, you know, never built to eat. So what's coming next is, you know, hopefully this, you know, lull in invasion stays, you know, this way, and we don't get another new noxious invader, and we kind of let this ecological reset take place. It's not going to be, you know, popular with everybody because the salmon are a huge recreational fishing industry here, huge. And lake trout just don't draw anglers to the lakes in the same way. But lake trout were built to live here, and, you know, they belong in this ecosystem. And for a long time, they weren't reproducing on their own. And it's kind of complicated, but a big reason was they were eating these alewives, and the alewives were creating a thiamine deficiency in their offspring that would prevent them from reaching maturity. But with the alewives gone on Lake Huron, they're now reproducing naturally to a great degree, and they're actually talking about eliminating a stocking program for them.
Well, we love to hear an environmental issue that has a glimmer of hope on the horizon that has a silver lining like this.
We try.
Yeah. Hopefully things shake out. And like I say, there's some kind of new equilibrium reached where the lakes are much more self-sustaining than needing these predators to be planted by the millions every year.
Well, before we wrap up, tell our listeners where they can learn more about your writing and your work and find your new book.
Well, I don't know. I work at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and that's easily accessible online, that's thejournalsentinel.com. And my book is published by W.W. Norton, and it's available on Amazon, obviously. I'm not sure if it's available at any local bookstores out west. I would hope so. I mean, I spend a chapter, you know, talking about what we've just been talking about, how the Great Lakes really are a beachhead for these invasions that end up spreading across the continent.
Well, we'll have to talk to our local bookstore, Dolly's, if you're listening.
It was a wonderful read, Dan.
And we really enjoyed the book. And thank you so much for coming on the air this morning.
Thanks. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
All right. Thanks, Dan. Let's take a break for some final underwriters and sponsors. We come back to wrap up. It's This Green Earth.
Support for KPCW programming has been provided by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting Utah's remaining Red Rock Wilderness lands. SUWA and Utah's Red Rock Wilderness need your support now more than ever. To learn more about how you can become involved, please visit the SUWA website at suwa.org.
Hi, I'm Carolyn with Recycle Utah. Did you know that we offer a commercial paper shredder? It's located behind the mixed paper bin, and anyone is welcome to use it. Shredded white paper can be turned into 100% recycled content paper again. Fees do apply.
Recycle Utah is your community nonprofit recycling center since 1990 and a KPCW supporter.
Hey, this is Nick Spitzer.
Hi, I'm Davey Ratchard from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain hosts winter events throughout the season, including the annual Torchlight Parade, New Year's Eve celebration, Spring Groove, and more. More information about all Park City Mountain events can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Park City Bike Demos, Kearns Boulevard next to Adolph's, parkcitybikedemos.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Hey, time to wrap things up. Another This Green Earth episode. Thanks again to Brian McInerney and Dan Egan for coming on the show. Let's thank our underwriters and sponsors who make this show possible. They include
Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties,
San Francisco Design,
and Park City Mountains.
Remember to email us with your thoughts, comments, and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org. This is KPCW.